Sarah Borjas, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And congratulations on your new book, Heart Like a Window, Mouth Like a Cliff. And there's been so many reviews on this book. It's doing pretty well for a first book of poems, isn't it?
I think so. You know, I'm learning as I go along, but it's really nice. Just people in the community, people that you know, like kind of admire from afar, start to see you back, you know, when you have a book come out.
Uh-huh.
And it's, the seeing has been the coolest part, you know?
And this is your first book, and I hate to fast forward, but I got to ask you, does having a first book motivate you to start working on the second, or are you just taking time off for a while?
You know, to be honest, I'm just taking time off. I don't know if that's what happens with, like, just what, you know, every first book, or if it depends on your experience with, like, making that first book. Mm-hmm. I think for me, and I think for a lot of people, most people, I know the first book is like the heavy hitter, right? It's like
right. You,
all your personal stuff, everything you like had to get out to see what's under there. And so I need a breather, you know, after all that. It was pretty intense. And so I'm just taking my time, and I'm not really tripping off of what's coming next. I am working on more essays now that I'm actually excited about essays at the moment, and I figured those are kind of like leading me into like other subjects for questions I have about life, you know, and then poems.
Yeah, well, personally, I think it's healthy to be in the situation that you're in, to just, you know, not to rush a second book, because I think what happens a lot of times with first book writers, I know this happened to me, is I'm immediately thinking, oh my God, what am I going to do next?
Yeah.
And that leads to a bad second book.
Yeah, which would not be fun. And yeah, it's not a product.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a product. Not yet. You know, I don't feel that way right now in my life.
Well, you know,
I
love the poems, and I want to go deeply into some of them. But first, I want to talk a little bit about your experience with Canto Mundo. I'm not sure everybody knows what that is, so maybe you can tell us a little bit about being a part of that poetry organization, poetry movement. I'm not even quite sure how to how to classify it, but it's an incredibly important contribution to Latinx poetry. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience?
Yeah, so Canto Mundo, is an organization that like nurtures and cultivates Latinx poets in the United States. Similar along the lines with Cave Canem, nurtures African American poets, and Kundiman with Asian American poets. And it's what it ends up being is the one time, like a week long retreat once a year, where there's about 30 Latinx poets who get together, and do a lot of deep work, and that means like generative work as far as poetry, like having discussions that need to be had within like the safety like of our own community, and then kind of like looking forward and laying out a plan for when we go back home, how are we going to bring what we just learned about ourselves back to where we come from and where we teach and where we write. And my experience, I was a fellow, I think twice, I want to say it was a fellow in 2016, 2017. And, you know, it really changes you. Right. I think if you're ready to be changed, you know, it depends. It's really intense, but you meet a lot of people who just see you that you don't have to explain yourself to.
Right.
And you start having conversations and being motivated at the edge of your thinking. Like, you know, you go to a lot of space and you kind of have to evolve with a group of people to get on the same page. But when you go to Canto Mundo, you're already at the edge of the very same page. You're just floating over to the next one. And so there's a lot of internal emotional work that gets done, so that when you get back home, you feel empowered to do those things and you know you're not alone, you know?
Right. You said you don't have to explain yourself, and this is kind of an important point, I think, because you got your MFA at UC Riverside, which is a fantastic program. I mean, they have or had Juan Felipe Herrera. They have so many great poets and fiction writers there. So I'm sure that the workshops were very edifying. But nonetheless, the MFA experience in itself can sometimes be a little exhausting for Latinx poets and writers, because we always feel like we have to be a cultural ambassador or something. We have to teach about our culture.
and
with Canto Mundo, you don't have to do that.
You don't have to do any of that. You don't have to do any of that. And if you get caught doing it, you get comforted and you're like, hey, you don't need, or if you get caught performing, we hold each other accountable. Like, you don't need to do that here. In fact, think about this. Here's a way that I do it. Or here's a way that I've seen someone else do it. And it just kind of opens you up without saying, you're being too Latinx. You're not being Latinx enough. You're not being the right kind of Latinx. There's just like an understanding.
Right, right.
That there's more than one way to be Latinx, and then moving forward from there.
Right, right. Your book, Heart Like a Window, Mouth Like a Cliff, starts with a poem called Aztlan. And as most Chicanx poets or Chicanx people know, that Aztlan is the you can say it's the mythical homeland of the Aztecs, but it is essentially the Southwest United States, including California. It's, we oftentimes say Califatlan, for example. But I love the way it starts. As I cannot explain this luxurious farm of losers, or these girls who drink two buck chuck all night. That's a really lovely first line. And I'm wondering, with this poem opening the entire book, are you opening a conversation about what it is to be, and I'm going to use your own words here, what it is to be a pocha, what it is to be a Chicano poet, and what it is to be from Fresno, too, because that two buck chuck part is great. People here in El Paso don't know what two buck chuck is.
What?
Yeah. And in fact, Sergio right now is shaking his head. What the heck is two buck chuck? But by the way, now it's $2.50. So that's, did you know they raised it? Can you believe that? But tell us a little bit about this poem and how this poem is appropriate to open up the conversation and the language of this book.
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right about what I'm trying to do with this poem. And I think for me, like, a major question that I'm always wondering is, like, how, in what ways am I Mexican, like, culturally? Like, because I know I am now,
right.
But my whole life, I didn't know that, I didn't know that. And then, you get tested throughout, where you fit in, where you don't. And then there's that essay that Viet Thanh Nguyen wrote where he said, if I'm moved by Vietnamese things, that's what makes me Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel the same way about Mexican. If I'm moved by Mexican things, the Mexican culture, then I am Mexican. I feel it. And so I think especially being from the Central Valley, being from Fresno, and the history of just agriculture and farm work, mm-hmm. that goes down in the Central Valley. I think it's really specific. I think it's also because it's California, and also because you're around a lot of other communities, like a lot of Filipino communities, Hmong communities, Punjabi, a bunch of folks who are trying to be American,
because
to survive, there's this, question always of, like, how am I still a brown person of color? How am I also American? What does it mean that I'm from this town that everyone disses, or that people don't know where it is in the first place? And I think that's too why I titled it Aztlan, because it is a mythical place. It's a place that doesn't literally exist, but it exists, like, spiritually as well, and that we kind of have to like solidify for ourselves. And for me, in this book, I had to say, like, this is real, you know,
right.
Even though this is a farm of losers, even though we're drinking this cheap ass wine, even though no one knows who's going to take Mary home tonight, we're still going to get drunk in this barn, and we're just as Mexican as we've ever been, and we're just as American as we've ever been, and we're just as real and important and part of a lineage as we've ever been.
Right.
And so, and I thought it was important also to kind of nod to biblical figures and to the Bible, because I think, you know, in my family, especially from my dad and, you know, my dad's side of family who are, you know, hella Catholic, they really feel like made real by the stories in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
They really feel like their struggles and stuff get like validated. You know, I'm a real person. This really happened. And this makes me like stronger. And I see like the power they get from that. And I kind of wanted to also lean into that and say, like, this is also this book, like books and poems and things like this are also part of that, making us real. And they're also, maybe they never happen, you know?
Wow. You know, that's...
but it's important that we make them feel real so that we can go forward.
Right. You know, and that's interesting that you know, I'm starting to understand your book, I think, on another level, on the spiritual level, because you do have these, you have this wonderful line. I forget which poem it is, but I wrote the line down. I think it's so beautiful. You say, God, you can't keep bumping into me like a cracked beer bottle. You know, and I love that. I love that very, you know, it's like, you know, our spiritual experience sometimes is like that. But in this poem about Aztlan, and Aztlan, again, is a spiritual place, is that you write, God is on a beer run. Jesus and Mary argue about who's driving them home. Eve's phone is dead. And I love those. I love those references. That and it is kind of an invocation of in this poem. Or this poem is kind of an invocation, if you want a benediction to welcome us into the book and what to expect in the book. I like to ask poets this a lot. The order of the book, at what point did you know this was going to be the first poem?
This is probably, like, honestly one of the last moves I made, because it wasn't in this form. It was probably like a third the length of what it is now. And my editor, Carmen Jimenez-Smith, and Blas Falconer as well, they were nudging me, and they were saying, like, this poem is like, could be an opening, but not as it is. You know?
Right.
And so I had to work on it till the very, very, very end. And I swear it's the last thing I did. It's the last move I made, was put it at the front.
Well, that actually makes a lot of sense, because I think once you have your entire collection, and I know a lot of poets have done this, at least they do this, you know, on social media, they'll print out all their poems and they'll put them on the floor. And they'll look at them and say, okay, well, what order does this... Did you do that, by the way? Did you print them out and put them on the floor?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then I saw people's photos on social media. I was like, oh, there's better ways to do this. Like, I definitely did that.
You know, when I tried to write a book of poems, and I was working on one for almost 10 years, and after 10 years, I did that. I printed them all out and... put them on the floor, and I took a picture of it and I put it on Facebook. But you know, now I, you know, by the way, the book was horrible and it remains horrible and it will never see the light of day. But there was something refreshing about that. And also there's something about getting that bird's eye view, even if it's just, you know, a metaphor, but getting that bird's eye view of everything you've written and everything that belongs in the book, and then making that arrangement. So I think that the fact that you begin with Aztlan, which is a language that we use in Fresno, that the Chicano community uses in Fresno, and you ended with a poem about tamales was, you know, wonderfully, wonderfully chosen.
You know, and I do want to say, too, it wasn't like, oh, I just thought about this shit. Like, I did, you know, I am like referencing Andres Montoya's the ice worker sings when he starts with Aslan, and he says, you know, I went looking for Aslan, but all I found were, like, towns with names like Parlier, Early Mart, and, like, Porterville. And so I was following him to what I made that move.
Right. And we're talking to Sarah Borjas. Her new book, Heart Like a Window, Mouth Like a Cliff, which is a collection of poems. And probably the people who listen to this show are probably thinking, oh, Chacon, you know, another Fresno poet? Why so many Fresno poets? But the fact is, there is so much poetry coming out of Fresno that if I were to, you know, limit Fresno poets based on them being from Fresno, I would have limited a lot of people. I mean, I've had Philip Levine on the show, I have you on the show, Juan Felipe Herrera on the show. Both Tim and I are, you know, have roots in Fresno. But you are clearly adding to the Fresno tradition of poetry. You truly have become a Fresno poet, which isn't to say that your poems are just relevant to Fresno, but I'm wondering what it is, do you think, about the tradition and the spirit and the whatever you want to call it about Fresno that causes so much poetry or allows for so much poetry? And then you mentioned that you might have roots in El Paso?
You know, well, my mom is from Texas, and they moved around a lot. And I do have some tias in El Paso as well.
Right.
But my mom and my grandpa's side, they're kind of spread out all around there, mostly in, like, Brownsville and, like, McAllen.
Okay, yeah, that's way far from us. I think Fresno's closer to us than McAllen.
Yeah, but what they did was, you know, my grandparents split up, and then they traveled. My grandma with her mom, my aunts, like, drove and traveled and ended up in Fresno. But they lived a lot of places along the way, and I think El Paso was one of them.
Yeah, yeah. And I have this theory that if you were to go deeply into the biographies of most Latinx writers, Chicanx writers, you would find that they have roots in both Fresno and El Paso somehow.
Whoa. Interesting.
Yeah, I was even thinking about doing an anthology about poets from Fresno and El Paso. I think it would probably include almost the entire community.
Yeah.
But let's get back to that. What do you think about the tradition of Fresno poetry and where you belong in it and what Fresno poets have influenced you?
Yeah, you know, this is something I think about because here are the ideas that I feel like I'm always trying to reconcile. You know, the first is that Fresno has a major strong presence that I learned about much later in my life. You know, I was writing and was applying to grad school when I learned that there was, like, an anthology called The Fresno Poet.
Oh, yes, I remember that anthology.
Yeah. So what does it mean that I'm a Fresno poet writing in the tradition of the Fresno poets, but I didn't know that there were Fresno poets? You know?
That is weird, yeah. But I think it's
normal. And then another idea is, like, well, once you figure it out, what does that do to you? You know, and at first I think it scared me a little. I felt a little bit of pressure. Like, okay, well, now I realize that I'm part of this lineage. I need to make sure, like, I do right by it. And after I got over that, I was more just empowered and not so much scared of fitting into the lineage, but more, like, excited to, like, broaden what it means to be from Fresno, what it means to be, like, a pocha, what it means to be wanting to be white, but never going to be white, you know? And I think some of them, I think probably the most influential poets have been Juan Felipe Herrera, not only because I worked with him, but because
he's Juan Felipe Herrera.
Yeah. And he's like loyal without being loyal.
Right.
You know, he's he reps, you know, himself and his place so hard, but he never, ever, ever says, like, this is the only way. If anything, he's like, how can we derail what we're already doing? How can we like, break it up? And also Larry Levis, and I think mostly because he always will get you in his poems where he just asks, you know, that deep question, and what does it matter that I even say this? You know, what does it matter that I'm never going to love someone like that again? Mm-hmm. And then he just moves along like nothing happened. So, and I think I'm kind of figuring out, like, right now, I'm in the midst of figuring out, like, what it means to be a Fresno poet. And I think that now I do feel a responsibility. You know, I do feel like I want to make, you know, Latina poets more visible within the Fresno canon.
Right.
I want to encourage us to, like, lift each other up, like, wherever we go, like Confamundo, you know, once you make those, you know, those connections, that's your family. And wherever you go, like, you take them with you in some way. And it's the same, I want the same thing for Fresno poetry, where no matter where we go, because we're all spread out now, how do we, like, bring Fresno in? How do we broaden what it means? Like, how do we get other folks to see us? Mm-hmm. And how do we, like, instill a sense of, like, dignity in people from Fresno? You know, I have this book now, and my family's like, oh, shit, people read it. People know my name, and they feel alive, and they feel seen, and that's what I think, like, we can do as Fresno poets moving forward as well. And that's what, I'm hoping, being included in that, you know, that I can do.
You know, you have this poem called Ars Poetica, which came out in Plowshares recently. And I remember I was in that same issue. And so I was reading it, and I read your poem, and I was blown away by it. And I think one of the incredibly important things about this poem and about what you're doing in this book is you are not only contributing to the tradition of Fresno poetry, but you are also responding as a woman. You're responding as a woman to male-centered poetry. And Juan Felipe Herrera is a unique poet because he's male, yet at the same time, he doesn't write from a, you know, he never even borders on misogyny. He never borders on, you know, gender bias. But you have this wonderful line, and you know I edited Andres Montoya's posthumous clone. You know, but you have this wonderful line. It says, I did not read The Ice Worker Sings before I was a poet. And you say, I will not praise the poems about how sex with a prostitute can clear some cochino path to male enlightenment, or that confessing I can hear the brown and black whores calling my name vindicates a Chicano's colonized mind. Well, it's an important book. It's an important book not only for Fresno poetry, but for Latinx poetry and for American poetry and Latin American poetry. And I wish we had more time to talk about it, because I wanted to talk about the tamales, which is one of my favorite poems in the book. But unfortunately, we're running out of time. Can we have you read a poem? Maybe the poem about the tamales?
Yeah, sure, of course. Yeah, and thank you for calling me, for having me, and for just doing Words on a Wire. So,
well, thank you for deepening. Thank you for deepening poetry.
You're welcome. Okay, there are tamales here. Even though some say those tamales are obligatory and sentimentalize the old way of being Mexican, there are tamales from last Christmas in the freezer. You can fight your sisters over them, or you can gift them to your white friends from high school when they call a few days before Christmas. You know what they want. They want tamales. Our hands lift each husk like a boyfriend's condom after sex. No, I don't mean the tamale is unwrapped like understanding for old or present ways. I said lift. I said tomorrow. Not unbury. Not please. I'm trying to say that tamales roots despotra's life, that it should not be left out of this narrative or replaced with the shadow of a tamale or the sound a tamale makes or the sound a mind makes when trying to forget a tamale or anything else, because there are tamales in the freezer full of beans and cheese and chicharrones and chilies. And no, there is no performance or language in my body that did not originate in the same place tamales did. And they won't stop being delicious. They won't be excused from my inheritance. And tomorrow morning, more tamales will be sold at the Vallarta and across the street from Franklin High by a woman who wears a white baseball cap that says, "I bought California." And her breath and mine crawl over each other in this air. But this is not developing chisme. There are tamales. I spread the masa. I roll the pork. I drink the juice, and I'm good at all of it. When we finish making tamales, my mom wraps them up in foil and writes my biblical name on them. I put them in the freezer and save them for people I love. And maybe on Tuesday, I'll eat them with scrambled eggs or some green smoothie or with my woke non-Mexican boyfriend on my IKEA plates, lifting the husks off with manicured hands. I don't want to share tamales with anyone I don't love. My pochamero is not rasguache. It is remarkable. It is capable of forgiveness and loyalty. It belongs to things I do not explain myself to. The dead camellias next to my bed. The palm. My mother. Her mother. The energy that dissenters this woman I thought I would be.
That was Sarah Borjas reading There Are Tamales Here from her new book, Heart Like a Window, Mouth Like a Cliff. I love that poem. I love the line where you say, "My pochamero is not rasguache." I love that you're using the word rasguache.
I was like, yes, I'm going to put this in here.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Thank
Check
you.
Out her webpage, sarahborjas.com. And we wish you the best of luck with this book. It's fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Dan.